We will be going through a few psalms in between the book of Romans, and we'll be starting the book of Exodus in 2, 3, or 4 weeks. So in between there, we kind of pick up a few psalms and one chapter in Proverbs. We're in Psalm 48 this morning. We'll read the text as we go through it, so we won't read it to begin with. But you will notice, as we looked at, when we was looking at Psalm 46 and 47, there is an inscription there, or a subheading, at the beginning of the psalm, which says, a song, a psalm of the sons of Korah. And let me remind you again that these headings that are put in front of several psalms throughout the 150 psalms in the Bible are not something that your word study editor put in there for you. They were there just as much in the text, just as much as the psalm itself. And we see here that this is a psalm of the sons of Korah. We saw a couple of weeks ago that this group of people, the sons of Korah, we're not sure who they were. They're perhaps a special group that sang or played, but you'll see this heading at a number of psalms, and you see I've got them written there, chapters 42, chapters 44 through 49. You'll see it in chapters 84 and 85, and also in 87 and 88. There's something else in the psalm that you'll see regularly throughout the psalms, and it's the word Selah or Selah. You'll see it after verse 8 in our psalm this morning, just one time in the psalm. And that itself is a word that means to pause and reflect, to reflect on what you have been hearing, what you've been singing or saying. So those are elements that are in the psalm that are common to many of the psalms. But this morning, if you have an outline, I hope you'll follow along. If you have a pen, I didn't put many blanks on it. You can fill them in. But my points are 4 points, and they're all questions. I want to ask 4 questions from this psalm for us to consider what it says. And the first question is this: what is Mount Zion? What is Mount Zion? Or to put it another way, what is the city of our God that we will read about? Now let's read the first 3 verses and see what they say. Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised. That was the song that we sung a couple of songs back. Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised. In the city of our God, there's this phrase that we're asking a question about. What is this? Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in his holy mountain. Beautiful in elevation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. God is in her palaces. He is known as her refuge. Let's stop there for a few minutes. What is Mount Zion? What is this city that he's talking about? A couple of psalms ago, we saw this phrase, and we talked about it being Jerusalem in that context, and perhaps even a prophetic sense there as well of a future Mount Zion. But these 3 verses sort of summarize this whole psalm. 14 verses in the whole psalm. These 3 verses sort of sum it all up. But we want to ask the question, what is this city? What does this mean? It almost seems as if the psalmist is referring to God as a city. Well, from these 3 verses, there are several things we can see about this city. The first one is that it is beautiful in its lofty. This version may say elevation, and this is height, but it's a city to behold in its height. Height speaks to us of a majestic thing. It says also it brings the supreme expression of joy more than anything else on the earth. This city is the joy of the whole earth. There is something about this city, whatever it may be, that is elicited naturally. I'm telling you, it elicits joy more than anything in the whole earth. It says that the side, or the city, is on the side of the north. The direction of north in the scriptures are poetically used to point to a place of prominence, point to a place of authority, point to a place of kinship. It says also that God is there in her palaces. Her seems to be a reference to this city. God is there in this city's palaces. So it seems that this city is large enough to encompass palaces. And palaces are something that probably none of us live in. But we know what they are. We know one when we see one. But usually they're seen from a distance. God is known, it says, for the refuge. So what is this city? I'm going to give you my thoughts as to what this poetic expression means. Remember, we're in Psalms. Psalms is a book of poetry. There are a lot of analogies. There are a lot of poetic forms, just like there would be in any poetry that we may read today. So I'm going to give you four or five things, and these are my thoughts. You can take them or leave them. The first one is this. The city of God is a poetic and prophetic monument, referring to a physical representation of God's presence. Let me say that again. The city of God, as used in this psalm, in a new psalm, is a poetic and prophetic. Thank you.
that that's what they say. There's something about that. What is it? Is it that it gets in my sense? Maybe that's it. That's what he wants them to do. They know that that person, that he is not, they certainly know what they call him as
know him intimately. And yet, we see the next phrase, he is known as her refuge. If someone is a refuge for something else, they're bigger than the thing they're a refuge for, aren't they? They're stronger, they're mighty, they're more capable. You see a young child, when something happens that frightens them or hurts them or something goes on that makes them uneasy, who do they run to? Mom. Thank you.
satisfaction is one that is filling. It's one that is good, but it still is leaves you wanting more. The city of our God. In this city are God's people who are experiencing satisfaction. The question number two is this. God's people are in this city. They're looking out the portholes. I'm not calling them windows. I'm calling them portholes. It's more of a military type term or a security type term. Looking out these portholes, and what do they see? Let's read verses 4 through 7. For behold, the kings assembled. They passed by together. They saw it, but they saw the city of God. And so they marveled. They were troubled. They hastened away. Fear took hold of them there, and pain as of the woman in birth pains, as when you break the ships of Tarshish with an east wind. So God's people, experiencing the refuge of God in the city of God, see something going on outside in the psalm. They see some kings who are assembled together, not just one king, but kings. They see an alliance of nations. Now, who are these kings? This is our second question. Who are these kings that are assembled, and what do they want? The context pretty clearly tells you this. They are the enemies of God. They are the haters of God. They're the haters of the church. They have come to defeat God. They are the hounds of hell coming for your soul and to accuse your soul before God. They'll find something wrong with me to justify their hatred of God. They enjoy that tactic because it's easy to do. It's easy to find something wrong with me. Wonder what they would have done in those Walmart people. They can put some of the most, I don't know what word to use, John says ridiculous in these times. Demeaning, there you go. Put all these people on there. Put a tag on them, Walmart people. If you look at those people, would you look at them and say, boy, that Sam Walton was a jerk, doesn't he? Would you look at the people that own these videos that they make them look silly and demeaning or you said or whatever and say, gosh, that Sam Walton was an idiot? No. No, you wouldn't. Why not? Because it's irrelevant. It has nothing to do with one with the other. And yet, let me give you another illustration. Susan occasionally sends me to a farm and usually have a sister calling a town to a calling to a gun by store and get this and this and this and this. And give me a little small grocery list to pick up. Occasionally, on that list is a bag of potatoes. I don't know if you noticed this or not, and I may be wrong, so you can correct me if I am. But a bag that you put potatoes in is different than a bag you put apples in. The difference is the potato bag has holes in it. Okay, now, I always thought that those holes were there to do a little ventilation for the potatoes in it so they didn't get moist and humid inside there and mildew and spoil. But that's not the best reason for the hole. The holes are there to smell the potatoes. Now, this is my theory. don't act like I just taught you something profound. Okay? Do you ever smell your potatoes when you buy them? Well, by George, you ought to. I do. Now, I look around. You know, I look around, make sure nobody's looking, then I stick my nose down one of them holes and I smell it back. You're probably right. Why do I do that? I'll tell you why. Because rotten potatoes stink. Have you ever stuck your finger in a rotten potato? Woo! And here's the thing. If I carry a bag of potatoes home that has one barely rotten potato, you know what Susan will do with that whole bag? Throw it out. The whole thing. I'd be right there with her if it smelled very bad. I can't stand the smell of rotten potatoes. And I lump the whole bag in with the one guilty potato. That's what the world does with Christians. There are a lot of people who bear Christ's name. There are a lot of people who wear his name. And because we hate God, or because people in the world hate God, because they think God is useless and powerless and doesn't even exist, they look for some way to justify their disdain of God Almighty, and they'll find it in you or in me, because we are not perfect. These kings that we see here in Psalm 48 are a little smarter than most people. They're not looking at the people in the city. They're looking at the city. They're looking at God. And what do they see? I don't know. All I know is their reaction. They marvel. They marvel at what they see. It says, lo, the kings assembled and passed by together. I get a visual image in my mind of these kings walking around the city looking at it, looking at the wall, looking at all of these things about the wall, and it says they marvel. I have never had anyone that I know of examine my Christian life and come away marveling. If they were, they were marveling that God would save me at all. But these kings are looking at the city. They're looking at God, taking note of things about God, and they are marveling. They're doing more than that. They were troubled, and they hastened to leave. That is the response
that the world ought to have when they look at God. They ought to be troubled. They ought to be to hasten, to back away from their evil intent and their foolish mouth. They ought to go away. Fear, it says in verse 6, fear took hold of them there. Fear as of, and pain. Fear and pain. And it gives a couple of analogies. Pain like a woman who is in birth, having birth pains. And fear as if you would have if you were on a ship and a storm came up and tore the ship apart. I've never been on a ship much at all. And I've certainly never on one in the middle of the ocean that a storm came up and literally tore the ship to shreds. Any of you? I didn't figure so. Ted maybe? Okay. I imagine that's a terrifying predicament. For a ship to be torn apart, and you're there. And the psalmist says, these kings' fear was that kind of fear. These are analogies. These are symbols. These are illustrations, comparisons as to what the king's fear felt like. Now, I want you to remember something else. That when a comparison is given, a comparison or an analogy is never as great as the thing that is the real thing. Okay, now you might could give an example or think of something like that. And if you do, it's usually either flattery or just a lie. Okay, take a small kid who goes in the doctor's office and gets a shot. He gets a shot in his arm. And he's 6 or 8 years old, and he's wailing and crying. And I remember me and my older sister, when we go to the doctor, we used to plan together in the back seat of the car, because back then they gave you shots. Every time you went to the doctor, they gave you a shot for something. They don't do that anymore. But we knew in the back seat, if he tries to give me a shot, I'm going to kick him, and I'm going to do this and do that. We just knew we was fixing to get a shot. And we would be crying and wailing and carrying on. And our parents would be, it's okay. It'll quit hurting in a little bit. It's not going to hurt bad. And if I was to say, no, it was an ice pick that they stuck in my arm. I'm comparing this pain to an ice pick. But what do? You just roll your eyes like, oh, it's not that bad. I'm giving you an illustration of something that is worse than the real thing, and you know what I'm doing. You know it's not right. But in normal situations like this one, a ship that is broken into, the fear that provokes in you and in these kings is not as bad as what the kings felt. These kings have received from God some measure of grace. It is a gracious gift from God to fear him. It doesn't say that they turned to him. It doesn't say they submitted to him. But the fear of God is the beginning of what? Wisdom. These kings are headed in the right direction. Fear of God. Let's go to number 3. Here's the third question. Let's read our text there. It's verses 8 through 11. The psalmist says, as we have heard, so we have seen. In the city of the Lord of hosts, there's that city again. In the city of our God, another description of it. God will establish it forever, Selah. We have thought, O God, on your loving kindness. In the midst of your temple, according to your name, O God, so is your praise to the ends of the earth. Your right hand is full of righteousness. Let Mount Zion, here's that descriptive phrase again. Let Mount Zion rejoice. Let the daughters of Judah be glad because of your judgments. So here's our question for number three. What do you think about what you have heard and seen? What do you think about what you have heard and seen? Now, notice that the first two phrases of verse 8. As we have heard, so we have seen. Now this is strongly implies this. That I have heard some things about God. Have you ever heard anything about God? I have. I've heard some things about God. And he says, as I've heard, so I've seen. What the psalmist is saying is these people in the city of God are seeing some things about God that correspond with what they've heard. Yes. This affirms what I'm seeing, affirms what I've heard about God. My parents said God was this way. I see what they meant. The teachers at church tell us this about God. I see now what they are saying. As we have heard, so have we seen. And this affirmation, it seems, prompts the psalmist or the people in the city to do what? Look in verse 9. We have thought. We are thinking. We have thought on God of your loving kindness. When you begin to know God, when you begin to understand God, there are certain things about God that come to your mind. God's love. The loving kindness of God. And according to your name, O God, so is your praise. Knowing God elicits praise from your heart, from your lips. Your right hand is full of righteousness. These things about God we see. God is a righteous God. Let Mount Zion rejoice. Let the daughters of Judah be glad. Why? Because of your judgments. Do you trust God? Do you trust God's decisions? When we hear that word judgments, we tend to think of a legal usage of that word. But the word judgment just means to distinguish between one and another. To make a determination. In the legal sense, it makes a distinction between innocence and guilt. In a moral sense, which those are one is a subgroup of the other, I suppose, it's a distinction between what is moral and what is immoral, between what is right and what is wrong, between what is good and what is evil. You make judgments all day long. You make decisions all day long, whether to wear the blue socks or the red socks, whether to eat the green beans or the Snicker candy bar. You make judgments. We all make judgments. What do you think about God's judgments? What do you think about God's decisions? Have you heard something about God? I've heard things about God all of my life. Things that God did. I've heard of what God did. I've also seen what God has done. What do I think about God's judgments? I can't think of one thing. I can't think of one time that God's decisions, God's judgments, that I looked at that and said, that is wrong. Now, immediately, there will be a million people over the world who would say, I beg to differ. If God is just, If God's judgments are right, why is there evil in the world? There is evil in the world, first of all, because we are evil. I sin not because God makes me sin, but because my heart wants to sin. I sin because I am a sinner. Number four. And this, I should have done some research about this, but there, it seems to me like there are a few times in the Psalms where the psalmist commands us to do something in the psalm. Praise is one that's very common that he does, but not in this degree. Now let's read verses 12 to 14. The psalmist tells us, now think of the context. You've got the city of God. God's people are in there experiencing refuge. They have seen God's deliverance from all the kings assembled about them. And they are praising God and thinking upon his loving kindness, his righteousness. And the psalmist tells them then this in verse 12. Walk about Zion. Go all around her. Count her towers. Mark well her bulwarks. Consider her palaces, that you may tell it to the generation following. For this is God, our God, forever and ever. He will be our guide even to death. Here the psalmist gives us some imperatives. The psalmist gives us some commands. Do this. Four or five words. Look at what they say. Walk about Zion. Walk about the city. Is that inside the city or outside the city? I don't know. I would say probably both. The next one, go all around her. This makes me think he's talking about outside the city. Outside the city is where you see the attributes of God. You have just seen the kings who are assembled around the city, and they marveled at the city and were filled with fear. It might be good for us to occasionally go outside the city and see what the heck they saw. What is it about God they saw that filled them with fear? We might need some of that. Walk about Zion. Go all around her. Count her towers. Notice how specific he's getting. Mark well her bulwarks. See, count the towers. Here is a tower for defense and for viewing. Here's another tower. A bulwark is a position to take, to do battle from, to defend yourself against a strong attack. Pay attention to those things. Know God. Study God. I suppose every generation experiences this. I don't know. But it seems to me that my parents' generation, if there was one thing that the church people did not do that I think hindered the next generation, it was this very thing: studying God. I've been in church all of my life. All of my life, my dad had us in church. I never even considered telling him I didn't want to go. That wouldn't have went over very well at all. We were there. But my dad was just like all the other dads in that church, practically all of them, and any other Christian dads that were regularly attending church that I knew about. They had this in common. They went to church, they made sure I was in church, and that's the end of it. That's the end of it. There was a real abdication of their responsibility to study God and to teach me what they were learning. If I didn't get it in Sunday school, I didn't get it. If I didn't get it from listening to the preacher, I didn't get it. And that's not a knock on my dad. It seemed like everyone was that way. It seemed like Sunday school was going to be your savior to teach your kids things. But it's not. It cannot be. There are kids in children's class right now. They're not my kids. They're some of your kids. If that's all they get, is what they get every other Sunday back there, you are doing your children a disservice, a horrible disservice. Study God. Why does he say you should study God? Why is he saying that you should walk about Zion? Why? Why is he saying to go all around her? Why? Why is he saying to count her towers, to mark well her bulwarks? Why? He tells you why. So that you may tell it to the generation following. And he ends with this proclamation. He says, "For this is our God. He is our God forever and forever. Even to the end of my life," he says, "this is my God." Is he yours? Can we say that personally? Look at verse 14. I'm going to read it. You may not have the same version I've got. I'm going to change those words "our" to "my." In your heart, say it to yourself. For this is God. My God, forever and ever. He will be my God, even unto death. When we see God, when we know God, when we study God, the most natural, rational, responsible thing to do is to yield and say, "God, you are my God." Let's pray. God, help us to see you the way the psalmist saw you. God, help us to hunger and thirst for you and to be satisfied. Amen.